Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. We again start with Craig's most recent column in the Florida Phoenix, floridaphoenix.com. I enjoyed this one as well because it takes us back to the origins of the Endangered Species Act, which of course has numerous Florida connections.
Yes, the idea for the act actually came from a Florida man, Nat Reed, who grew up in the Jupiter area and loved fishing and butterflies and birds and so forth. And when he became Assistant Secretary of the Interior in the Nixon administration, he became very alarmed at reports about wildlife disappearing all over the United States. So he gathered some other like-minded federal officials together at a Chinese restaurant off Constitution Avenue, and they worked out the wording for what became the Endangered Species Act, which Congress passed nearly unanimously and Nixon signed into law in 1973.
Yeah. Amazing when you think how far we've come. Okay. This was a Republican government official from Florida in a Republican administration in Washington spearheading the nation's greatest piece of environmental legislation. Imagine that happening today. Imagine Rick Scott or someone like that going to Washington and spearheading what would become 50 years worth of the greatest clean energy. It is unthinkable. And it goes to show how the conservation and the environmental movement over the subsequent 50 years from Nixon to today has simply become another culture war partisan battleground.
Yeah. And I mean, and it passed, it was a bipartisan vote in Congress. Yeah. But the point of the column was not the Endangered Species Act. It was a particular endangered species added to the list in 1973, 50 years ago, a little fish called the Okaloosa darter, called that because they dart around and it lives in these little clearwater streams in the panhandle in Okaloosa and Walton counties. The Okaloosa County Commission was outraged that it would be listed as endangered species because you couldn't eat it. And it was causing them all kind of problems with a bridge project. And now here we are 50 years later. And because of some really dedicated people fixing its habitat, the darter has come back and there are hundreds of thousands of them now. We were down to 1,500 at one point. There are hundreds of thousands of them now, and they have been officially taken off the endangered species list. Yeah. They are no longer in any danger of extinction. And it's a big victory.
And people will be, well, let's start with this. You think of the Endangered Species Act, you think the charismatic megafauna, you think panther, you think grizzly bear,
manatees,
alligators, that sort of stuff. It also protects insects, fish, bats, birds, butterflies, plants, name it. So this is an example of one of those, you know, smaller species that no one has ever heard of that was saved by this act. Just like the alligator was saved by the Endangered Species Act, just like the brown pelican, something now ubiquitous,
bald eagle.
You know, so many of these species have been brought back from the brink of extinction by this act. How does the Endangered Species Act work? What makes it beneficial to the plants and animals that are placed on the list?
It provides a level of protection, particularly from any federal action. And because the Okaloosa darter lives primarily on Eglin Air Force Base, that meant the Air Force had to basically do everything they could to save it. And so the Air Force Base folks worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and they did a number of things to fix what humans had done to screw up the habitat. They cleaned up some clay roads and clay borrow pits that were eroding into the streams and basically covering everything. They worked out ways to put in new culverts that would provide the fish with ways to get back and forth. And my particular favorite example, there was an area in the base golf course where they were, in order to make it still accessible to golfers, they were going to put in a new 200-foot culvert in order to allow the stream to freely flow back and forth. But 200 feet, it's going to be dark in there. Mm-hmm. And the darters don't like dark places, unlike some politicians I could name. And so one of the guys said, well, what if we put in manholes and the manhole covers are made of plexiglass? Basically, we'll put in skylights for the fish.
Yeah.
And it worked. It worked. And the fish loved it. They swim through it all the time.
And if all of that sounds incredibly arduous and expensive and long, you are 100% right. It is so much easier to protect these species on the front end than the back end. This is the classic preventative maintenance. You know, it's exercise and watch your weight as opposed to getting type 2 diabetes and then being on medication in doctor's offices the rest of your life.
Well, but it wasn't that expensive in the long run. I mean, one guy I talked to estimated they were spending $200,000 a year out of a defense budget that's $1.3 trillion, you know, it's not a lot of money comparatively. Yeah.
FloridaPhoenix.com. It is hurricane season, and Windstorm Products is a locally owned Florida company that has evolved into the largest online retailer of hurricane hardware. They've got the bolts and the screws and the wing nuts and the hardware and the wrenches and all this stuff you need to protect your, you know, shutters and your patio furniture and all this kind of thing from hurricane wind damage. Most importantly of all to me, however, is the 800 number, the helpline, the service line in the upper right hand corner. If, like me, you live near the beach, and you are not a handyman Bob Vila type, and you don't know the first place to start or even what you need, give them a call and they will point you in the right direction. That might, right direction might be, hey, you're fine. Or it might be, you know, let us help you and we'll pick everything out and order it and ship it to you. Shipping's only $5. So windstormproducts.com. We also want to thank all of our patrons at patreon.com. patreon.com/welcometoflorida. For as little as $5 a month, you can personally support our production of this podcast and receive exclusive bonus content. There are 2 bonus podcast episodes up there exclusively for our patrons. So if you are passionate about keeping this podcast going, you can put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, at patreon.com/welcometoflorida. All right. We have a whimsical topic. We've had some heavy episodes in recent weeks, Craig, but today we talk about lighthouses, which I think, I hate to say everyone can agree on anything anymore, but I've yet to run across a person who is anti-lighthouse.
Yeah, it's a topic. I mean, everybody finds them at least charming or at least inoffensive. But you know, Florida being a coastal state, we have quite a few lighthouses here. So I saw Josh's listing in the Florida Humanities Council list of speakers, and I said, this is perfect. What a perfect person to talk on this subject.
Yeah. Florida has 2,000 miles of coastline, which is second only to Alaska. Anything having to do with geography in America, Alaska is going to come first. You have no idea how big it is. but 700 miles of beach also in Florida. Our second longest coastline in the country is protected by some 30 lighthouses, or was at one point anyways. Josh Liller is our guest. He is the historian and collections manager at the Jupiter Inlet Lighthouse. He is the editor of the Florida Lighthouse Trail book and an historian with the Florida Lighthouse Association. Here we go with Josh.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. People, I think, see lighthouses on the Florida landscape and kind of take for granted that they're there, but it took a lot of effort to put them there and then to keep them there. Who built the first lighthouse in Florida?
So the first lighthouse in Florida might have actually been the Spanish. There was a watchtower in St. Augustine that there's some instances that suggest that may have been an aid to navigation, maybe even lighted in some way at night. And that watchtower became the first St. Augustine lighthouse that's not there anymore, but that was when the United States got Florida in 1821. It was one of the first lighthouses they put in service because St. Augustine was one of the largest cities in Florida at the time. Most of the lighthouses in Florida then were not built, though, until the United States got Florida, and it was the lighthouse service, officially the U.S. Lighthouse Establishment at the time. It was a civilian part of the Department of the Treasury that was in charge of lighthouses throughout the country.
Treasury? Why Treasury?
Why Treasury? I guess because, but dating back to colonial times, lighthouses tended to be funded by tariffs and port duties and things like that, because since they were related to shipping.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why they put them in there. It was in Department of Treasury all the way up until 1903, when they created the Department of Commerce, got moved over there. And then in 1939, the entire lighthouse service was merged into the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard back then was also Department of Treasury, just moves into the Department of Navy when there's a major war. Now it's Homeland Security, I think.
When did the fanciful paint jobs come in? We think of the now St. Augustine Lighthouse with the black and white spiral. Your Zoom background there has the rust-colored, I believe that's Jupiter, inlet lighthouse. How did that get started? And these incredibly distinct visual signatures to lighthouses.
Yeah, so the distinct visual signatures are called daymarks. And early on, most lighthouses were just whitewashed. There were a few lighthouses like Jupiter that were left more or less unpainted for a while. But most of them were, you couldn't really tell them apart real well by the color. And so in the 1870s, somebody in the lighthouse service, I'm not really sure whose idea it was, came with the idea that they need to introduce day marks to make them a little more unique. In particular, starting to have some very unusual ones. Here in Florida, probably Cape Canaveral with the alternating bands of white and black and the barbershop pole look at St. Augustine are the only really distinctive ones like that. The rest are some simpler designs with, white, black, red, or brown. North Carolina is probably the most distinctive one, where they have one lighthouse. They've got Cape Lookout, which is diamond shapes on it for the day mark, and then Cape Hatteras with the barbershop pole like St. Sure. Augustine, and then Body Island has the rings of black and white. So depending how distinct the coast was, the less distinct the coast, the more distinct the lighthouses had to be.
And what's the oldest one that's still standing these days?
The oldest lighthouse that's still standing is Amelia Island, and it was 1830s. The actual material that makes up the lighthouse is older than that. It was built before the United States got Florida, but across the water on the south tip of Cumberland Island. And then after the United States got Florida, the ports on the south side, the channel before they started dredging it, curved around to the south, hugging the island. And just the way the channel naturally eroded the two islands, they realized it made more sense to have the island now on the lighthouse on Amelia Island. So they tore the lighthouse down in Cumberland and rebuilt it on Amelia Island. It's still there today.
You have a slightly used lighthouse, Chad.
Yeah. Well, I was telling Josh before we started recording, I'm embarrassed to say I've never been there, but the Amelia Island Lighthouse is really only open to visitors one day a week. I believe that the access is gated the rest. And then even during that one day, Saturday, like 3 hours, you can't climb it. So that's going to take me into my next question, Josh. As far as, okay, if people want to visit a lighthouse, yeah, there's one here in Amelia, it's not really the best to visit. What are the best lighthouses to visit where you can go up and look at the lenses and take all your pictures from, high above the landscape and that sort of thing?
So we have 30 surviving historic lighthouses in the entire state of Florida. Of those, about 10 of them have fairly regular access, about 10 have very restricted access, and about 10 of them have effectively no access. So the ones that have the best access are going to be Jupiter, Ponce Inlet, My Daytona, St. Augustine, and now that they got the base security issues straightened back out again, Pensacola. Those are the not just the four biggest, but also the ones that are open year-round most of the week. So you'll be able to have regular visitation and climbing on them.
Is 30 the most that any state has, or how does that compare to other states?
No, the state that has the most is actually Michigan. They really have over 100, because the entire state is two peninsulas.
Yeah.
And up there on the Great Lakes, because it's such a ragged coast with so many harbors and bays and things, they have a lot more small lighthouses, whereas here it's a mostly straight and low-lying coast, and so you don't need, you've got more lighthouses covering more, fewer lighthouses covering more area. Maine also has Florida Beat, just because, again, a very ragged coastline. New York, because you've got both sides of Long Island and Long Island Sound, and New York Harbor, and then some on the Great Lakes as well, and even a few on the Hudson Valley. California, because it's just a really long coastline. Florida is the fifth most, I believe.
Ah, who were the lighthouse keepers? Who went and tended the lights?
So from the inception of the Lighthouse Service up until the merger with the Coast Guard, these were civilian employees of the government. They were, starting in the 1880s, they were uniformed but non-military. Up until the late 1800s, it was a semi-politically appointed position. It was the collector of customs that would usually choose who the lighthouse keeper would be if there was a vacancy. Mm-hmm. Really early on, it could be, you know, even political patronage, to the point where, you know, if you had a good friend in Congress or something, and the president changed and now there's a different party in office, if you were the right party, you could bump somebody in the wrong party and get their job.
Hold your DeSantis jokes to the end of the podcast, please.
By about the 1850s, I think that sort of like super deep patronage had pretty much been done away with. And, you know, you would only be really replaced if you were not doing your job. By the 1890s, civil service finally reaches the lighthouse service. And at that point, it becomes a more, well, much less political thing, in that you're actually passing a civil service exam, and whoever scores the highest gets the, you know, first crack at an opening. And there's a much more structured system of seniority getting you elevated when there's an opening, and people being, just in general, being more career oriented in the lighthouse service. In the 19th century, there's a lot of keepers who, if they're a local person, hey, there's a vacancy at the lighthouse, I need to make a steady paycheck instead of being a farmer for a little while, or I've been a mariner at this port, I don't really want to, I'm going to, you know, go ashore and stop going out to sea so much now that I have a family. You know, some of them still served very long periods of time during the 19th century, but it was a lot more of a turnover and a lot more local people. In the 20th century, it's a lot more regional and a lot more people going career with 20 or 30 years in the lighthouse service and moving around between half a dozen to a dozen lighthouses over the course of their career as more appealing spots came open or they got promotions.
So what did they have to do? What were their duties?
So your biggest duty is, of course, keeping the light on at night. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, before the sun goes down, you go up there, you pull down the curtains, you fire up the oil lamp, which they were difficult mechanically a bit to get burning and running smoothly. It's not just like a candle. It's a series of concentric wicks. So it's very careful to burn that, get that burning properly, not get too hot, you know, crack the chimneys to get the exhaust out there and so forth. You wind up a mechanism that turns the lens. These were all Fresnel lenses for the most, by the 1850s, they moved into all Fresnel lenses, which had like a grandfather clock system where you wind up a weight and the weight descends and turns the lens around, and then every so often you have to wind it up again several times during the night. And the keeper would keep the light burning through the night. If there was a lighthouse that had more than one keeper, they'd normally switch off at midnight, and the other keeper would be there till dawn. Sometimes, you know, if there was one keeper, if they had a family there, they might get a little help to take a little nap or something. But the idea is to always have someone on duty to make sure the light is going and the lens is turning. First thing in the morning, you turn off you put out the lamp, you put up the curtains, you refuel the lamp and get it ready so that if a storm brews up or if you're in a hurry at the end of the day, that you can go right away. And then during the day, you've got the keepers have all the maintenance and upkeep of the station, and they have, especially with the oil lamps, cleaning the lens, cleaning the lantern glass so that you can see the light clearly, cleaning the lighthouse, the polishing the brasswork, cleaning, dusting the stairs, taking care of all the buildings. You know, they're living in dwellings at the lighthouse, so they've got to take care of all of those and the grounds and everything. If the supply tender brought the next 6 months of or years worth of fuel, helping to unload all that, the head keeper's got to take care of all his paperwork, you know, how much fuel is using, if they've seen what ships they've seen passing, a logbook of activities and what's going on there. corresponding with the district officers about what's going on at the station with maintenance and personnel issues and salary.
That's a lot to do. I mean, this was not an easy job.
It was not an 8-hour day job.
Well, just the maintenance. Anyone who owns a house by the sea, saltwater, knows the amount of corrosion and painting and just the regular upkeep from saltwater on any sort of structure.
The metal on lighthouses generally was painted once a year, which for a lighthouse like Jupiter is not too bad when you just have the ironwork up at the top that you need to paint. But there were lighthouses like Hillsborough Inlet or the lighthouses offshore in the Florida Keys. The entire tower is iron. And so you've got to repaint it every year, which would have been difficult. And of course, back then it's lead-based paint, so could be an impact on your health that you didn't realize.
Yeah. You mentioned the Fresnel lens. And for those of us who have been fortunate enough to go up in a lighthouse and look at that lens, it's got all these ridges and it's jagged and curved. I mean, is that the Fresnel lens? And what made it so advantageous to whatever had come previously?
Back in the couple centuries ago, lighthouses were just big lights, a bunch of candles, maybe some kind of reflector or something. Not very efficient. In the early 1800s, a Frenchman named Augustin Fresnel, the S is silent because he's French. Fresnel ends up revolutionizing the understanding of light, kind of discarding a misconception from Newtonian physics, and recognizes light as a wave and does some experiments to prove it. And then he's a civil engineer, and he realizes that, hey, this can be used to vastly improve lighthouses. And he develops a system where light, if it hits any surface, will, at too steep an angle, is going to bounce off. Doesn't matter how clear it is. So he uses this to his advantage. So the middle of a Fresnel lens is a lens like you think a magnifying glass or a eyeglasses, where it's kind of just catching the light and giving it one bend and kind of pointing out to see. But then he surrounds that with prisms, and the prisms will catch the light. It bends coming in, it hits the back of the prism, can't escape because of physics, bounces off at a 90-degree angle, hits the third side, is now going to the right direction. And it's a very wide beam, and this allows a lamp to be able to be visible much farther out to sea and much brighter than any lamp would otherwise be. And this Jupiter, just to give an example, is a first-order lens, so the largest regular kind of lens. It has 397 individual pieces of glass in it.
Wow.
There were lenses that were more, depending on the style of the lens, could have as much as 1,000 individual pieces of glass. And this has to be very high-end glass. Fresnel went to the best glass maker in France, who was considered probably the best glass maker in the world in the 1800s, and said, your glass is inadequate. You have to invent even better glass than you've ever had before. Because if you have a Coke bottle, if you have an air bubble in your Coke bottle, it doesn't matter. If you have an air bubble in a optic of a lens, it's going to affect how the scatter of the light. So it's not going to work. So it had to be very high quality glass, which requires special care. So you don't scratch it. So you cleaning the only certain chemicals. But this design was revolutionary. He got to see it initially implemented, had a lot of health issues and passed away. His brother carried on his work, advancing the design. And eventually it became not only used at every lighthouse in France, but after a lot of delays in getting into America, mostly on cost issues, eventually every lighthouse in America, England, essentially the whole world used Fresnel lenses. Nowadays, a lot of classic Fresnel lenses have been phased out of use because they're maintenance intensive. A lot of them have been, if the lighthouse is still active, they've been replaced by some kind of modern optic. But those modern optics are just advancing the science and technology of a Fresnel lens. And everything from stage lights to car headlights to dock lights, channel markers out there in the intercoastal waterway, even sometimes lights in your house are using the same principles of a Fresnel lens, of trying to, if not using actual individual prisms, just kind of ridging the glass ever so slightly to simulate a prism, mm-hmm. and bend light in a certain way to make it brighter.
How long is the distance those initial or let's say first generation, early generation Fresnel lenses are off to shore compared with what it was previously?
Early lighthouses probably were not really good beyond a few miles, especially if it wasn't really clear weather. I can't imagine really, you know, more than maybe 10 miles on even on a really big lighthouse. With a Fresnel lens, especially the larger kinds, a lot of times the functional limitation is more the curvature of the Earth.
Oh my goodness.
The distance of the horizon than it is the light itself. So here at Jupiter, because of the height of the lighthouse and a first order lens, depending on how big of a boat you're on, so how far you see over the horizon, you can see the light about 17 to 25 miles out to sea on a clear night.
Are there any really dramatic shipwreck stories involving Florida lighthouses?
One really good one is down in Miami off of Fowey Rocks, which is off the port of Miami, but on the Florida Reef that parallels the Keys. They had a lighthouse on Key Biscayne. They decided it wasn't big enough, couldn't see it far enough to keep people safely off the reef. So they start building this lighthouse on the reef itself in the 1870s. And while they're building the lighthouse, they have two shipwrecks that nearly hit the people building the lighthouse. Wow. It was really cemented that this was a really good idea to build this lighthouse. Really
and they told the construction crew, could you guys hurry up a little bit?
A lot of the lights down in the Keys are on parts of the reef or on sandbars and things down there that are named after shipwrecks that had predated the lighthouses. Carey's Fort, Alligators, not because it's shaped like an alligator, because alligators live there. Alligator Reef is because the USS Alligator wrecked there and while it was chasing pirates in the 1820s. Lighthouses have been pretty good about preventing shipwrecks to achieving their purpose. When ships have wrecked post-lighthouse, it's usually been a case of a really terrible storm or some kind of mechanical difficulty where the ship knew where it was and just couldn't do anything about it.
You mentioned post-lighthouse. When did technology, and I'm guessing, you know, sonar, radar, ship-to-shore communication, radio, all that sort of stuff kind of replace the need for these guys going up at night and, you know, lighting the lamp and maintaining lighthouses to make shipping safe?
In the early 20th century, you get some experience with acetylene gas and, more importantly, electricity. Either hooked up to a commercial power grid or just hooked up with a generator. And that makes lighthouse keeping substantially easier. No more oil lamp, but easier to fire up the light. In the 1920s, the lighthouse service starts introducing radio beacons. So they're transmitting a Morse code signal that ships can use to take bearings on where they are in bad weather in far greater distance than you can see the light. But those are usually double duty on a light ship or at a light station. In World War II, they invent LORAN during the war as a even longer range guidance system. And the Coast Guard, since they took over the lighthouse service, they go, hey, we're doing navigation already. We might as well also, you know, do LORAN because it's just a longer range aid to navigation. That's what LORAN stands for. It's really GPS that's the big tipping point. That is what makes LORAN and radio beacons obsolete. GPS being really rolled out, especially into the 90s, and then selective availability off in the early 2000s, makes GPS just so widespread use. The radio aids are largely discontinued. Also, technology by that time has allowed lights to just be automated. You have, you know, reliable timers, you have light sensors, you have solar-powered lights that will even provide the power in many cases and store them in batteries. Not just here in Florida, but nationwide. By the 1980s, the Coast Guard is automating the last of the lighthouses. And they still keep many lighthouses active, but it's basically just, hey, is this tower standing? Is the light still on? Mm-hmm. We've replaced the Fresnel lens in many cases with some kind of, you know, inexpensive modern optic, sometimes ones that are designed to specifically work off solar power. Not even necessarily as good as a Fresnel lens, but still useful to navigation. You know, once upon a time, lighthouses were your primary aid to navigation. Now they're secondary, but, you know, you never know when your GPS is going to get scrambled by a solar flare, or depending on your boat, your GPS might go overboard. The two stories, both Florida related, that I think illustrate the importance of lighthouses even in the modern era. One, there was a freighter off of Miami in the 90s that was hit by lightning, lost all of their navigational equipment. The only way they could get into port is because the navigator knew how to run a sextant and take bearings on the Fowey Rocks Lighthouse to guide them into port. The other thing is, here in Jupiter, we had a Loran station just up the road from us. The guys worked at the lighthouse as well as the Loran. Loran is completely discontinued nationwide in 2010. Because the 600-foot tall tower is a impact on risk on low-flying planes, it is taken down. All the fishermen complained up and down about this. None of them used Loran, but this 600-foot tall landmark was just a great point of reference. So,
wow.
You know, there's so many, you know, like the lighthouse stands out so much from all of the condos and things like that. So they still have their use.
I heard a story, I don't know if it's true, that the area in South Florida, now known as Bilbag State Park, was a sort of a jumping off point for the Underground Railroad for escaping slaves until the lighthouse was built there. Is that correct? Did that happen?
I think there is some truth to that. It was Spanish Florida, so the Spanish didn't really much care if slaves fled into Florida. And then the Bahamas were British, who were more anti-slavery than the United States was. And Cape Florida was a good point to, you know, if getting to the as far away from the United States to the south end of Florida wasn't far enough. Cape Florida is a good place to hop onto a boat to get across to the British Bahamas. So the lighthouse, you know, having federal employees there and having something that is safer for, you know, patrols of the government service to, you know, potentially catch people like that. I think the lighthouse did limit its ability to sneak over there anymore.
You have obviously been bitten by this lighthouse bug. You have devoted your life to it. Now, there is an undeniable romance and charm to lighthouse. There's books, there's movies, there's calendar. What is it for you personally or broader for like the lighthouse, you know, lover community? What is it about lighthouses that captivates you so much?
I think the popularity in general is just because a lot of people think they're really pretty to look at. To some people, it's also a bit of religious symbolism of a lighthouse in terms of a guidance thing. You'll even see inland places, you know, 100 miles from the coast that have a, you know, Lighthouse Baptist Church or whatever. So there's some symbolism there. For me personally, I was always interested in history to begin with, but it's learning more about lighthouses and how much there is uniqueness to the stories from one lighthouse to the next, but which also weaves into a larger national story, the advancement of engineering, the advancement of technology, the links to maritime service, many cases links to various military stations that were near lighthouses. The keepers themselves, you know, we had nearly 200 keepers at Jupiter between the civilian head and assistant keepers and then the Coast Guard keepers. Those 200 people have a wide range of stories, from local pioneers to, you know, future murder victims to guys who did 30 years in the Coast Guard. This lighthouse was the only lighthouse they worked at. They did, you know, rescues in the Cuban Missile Crisis and Loran stations in the Pacific and all sorts of just a variety of wild stories. So the lighthouse is what links together all these individual stories. The other thing, too, that for me specifically getting into it, and it's not just what the history is that's, oh, this is really cool. It's, wow, there is not enough research and not enough written about the stories associated with these lighthouses. You know, it's you come in, you just assume, oh, we already know all this stuff. And there's a lot of lost knowledge because people don't, it's just a lighthouse. It's, you know, no big deal. There, you know, it wasn't seen as important as we see it now as sort of this lost era of history. And so I really enjoy the opportunity to dive into something. My first love in history was the Civil War. Oceans of ink have been spilt about Abraham Lincoln and Gettysburg. A lot of lighthouses, of 600 lighthouses in the country, you can probably pick at least 500 of them. And if you wrote a book on that lighthouse, you would be the first person to ever write a book on that lighthouse. So the chance to make that contribution to history, I really appreciate.
What's your favorite story about a lighthouse keeper.
One of the most unique stories, I think, for our lighthouse is that our lens was turned by hand on three different hurricanes.
Oh my word.
Because one, the first time electricity hadn't happened yet, but the tower was just shaking so violently in the wind that it was affecting how the weight was going down, was descending, and so the keeper was turning it by hand. Another time during the Coast Guard era, they had electricity and the backup generator failed, so they have to go grab, you know, temporary lanterns and stick it in the lens, and the crew was turning it by hand. The most dramatic one was in the 1928 hurricane, the enormous, infamous Okeechobee hurricane that came through here. It rattled one of the part of the Fresnel lens loose. We damaged that. They were able to repair it, thankfully. So it gives us a bit of a unique Fresnel lens too. But the generator, the commercial power went out. The generator was destroyed. The building, the holding generator, was destroyed in the storm. And so the keepers, possibly even the teenage son of one of them, were turning it by hand during the storm. And then for the next 3 days until they get a replacement generator, the three families and the three keepers plus their families would take turns through the night. You know, since there's no longer a storm that you had to hunker down from, someone would go up there, you know, turn it for an hour by hand and then switch off to the next person so that, you know, your arm gets tired from that.
Jeez. Amazing.
Josh Liller has been our guest. If you are interested in Florida lighthouses, check out his Florida Lighthouse Trail book. This has been a blast, Josh. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you for guiding us through the lighthouse discussion. Very nice.
There is a Florida Lighthouse Association. Its goal is to help all of the individual lighthouse associations that work with specific lighthouses. They also, if you're driving around the state, you see the Jupiter Lighthouse on a license plate for Visit Our Lights. That is not just for Jupiter. That is supporting the whole Florida Lighthouse Association. The funds from that plate help support a really important grant program for the repainting and restoration of lighthouses, because, you know, they're all automated for the lights, but the maintenance hasn't become much easier from what it was 200 years ago. So there's a constant need to do that kind of upkeep with, as we said, the difficulty of being on the building on the coast. Those Florida Lighthouse Association has meetings around the state every year. And in some cases, those meetings provide boat trips or the opportunity to climb a lighthouse that you could not otherwise climb any other time of the year except that meeting, such as Amelia Island.
Fantastic. I'll put a link to the Florida Lighthouse Association in the show notes along with the book. Thank you so much, Josh.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Chad, what lighthouses have you been to?
I've been to the Jupiter Inlet Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. I've not been to St. Augustine, and I should go. How about yourself?
I've been to St. Augustine. We climbed the St. Augustine, like quite a view. And of course, you know, in a flat state, seeing things from that far up.
Oh, absolutely. Quite amazing. Jupiter Inlet, the same way. They've got wonderful grounds and a little, you know, historical, survey museum. But you see, obviously, for miles and miles, and you're looking over the ocean, you're looking over the intercoastal, it is a fascinating, fascinating view. This, you know, episode, if you find these topics interesting, from the back episodes, Houses of Refuge, pirates kayaking around Florida, barefoot mailmen, and then the 1928 hurricane, which he mentioned. We have full episodes on those in the back catalog. But the lighthouse thing is funny. I mean, there are so many people. They got the lighthouse bumper stickers. You go to their house, they've got all the lighthouse tchotchkes. I mean, it's a real community.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.